again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
There is a volcano of Democratic sentiment among a huge portion of American people. They want to build a society where people are working together, where we don't have poor people, where there's no corruption.
Coming up, we'll hear from one of America's leading activists on media about his new book on the prospects of political activism.
When the adversities of today seem impossible to deal with if you don't have a feeling of tomorrow.
And we'll hear from a 96-year-old Chicago civil rights activist who spoke about his experiences. But first, here's some headlines from the Indie Media Network. San Francisco Indie Media featured a bus blockade organized by teachers against some of the world's most famous tech companies. Teachers at San Francisco Bilingual Public Fairmont Elementary School joined with the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project to block three private buses. In a feature dated February 6, 2015, quote, "Buses from Google and Facebook were blocked as activists protested the takeover of what had been four parking spots for teachers at the school by a tech bus stop. Teachers had not been consulted before their parking stops were privatized in 2015, unquote. Protester Claudia Tirate stated, "In this city, gentrification does not only mean being displaced from one's home, but also from public spaces and city infrastructure, from parks to BART plazas to public bus stops. We are seeing public spaces increasingly privatized and surveilled." Atlanta Indie Media featured a story about Georgia prisoners going on hunger strike over harsh prison conditions. The feature reprinted a letter attributed to prisoner Kelvin J. Stevenson, dated March 6, 2015, who recounts his actions and his reasons. Stevenson writes, "Prisoners are stripped of all personal property and placed in a single occupancy cell with a roommate that has a toilet that has no inside flush valve and forced to live 24 hours a day receiving half-portioned food trays, thus deliberately malnourishing the prisoners into submission. Any prisoner that files grievances to complain about the denial of outside exercise periods, cell sanitation, law library access, telephone and visitation access to family, the mice and spider infestation, are targeted by administrators and subjected to assaults, and are sprayed with MK90 riot mace, which is used to subdue attacking bears. Stevenson has been refusing food since February 23rd and has asked for human rights and U.S. government investigations into the reported atrocities." Chicago Indie Media reported on the 2015 Chicago mayoral runoff with a feature headlined, "It's Jesus versus Satan in 2015 Chicago mayoral runoff." The headline alludes to the two finalists, Cook County Commissioner Jesus Chuy Garcia, and incumbent Rahm Emanuel. Rahm held a host of advantages in terms of money, endorsements, and a flood of TV and radio ads, and yet his policies in his first term have negatively affected most Chicagoans on everything, from mental health clinics and school closings. The result? The first runoff since Chicago switched to nonpartisan elections in 1996. Early polling has given Emanuel a slight lead, but endorsements from various groups and Chicago public figures have favored Garcia, who arguably has the momentum going into the runoff scheduled for Tuesday, April 7th. Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
So let me close where I began, with a shout out to 4 million Americans who took their time to share with us their views. Today, history is being made by a majority of this commission as we vote for a fast, fair, and open internet. And with that, I will call for the yeas and nays. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The item is carried.
That was FCC Chair Tom Wheeler on February 26, 2015, during the FCC's public vote on restoring net neutrality and placing it on much more solid legal ground. Though the vote and commentary about it has gotten headlines, much of the activism helping to make that vote happen has received little attention. And that's one of the great many examples of increasing fronts of positive political activism that's taking hold across America on everything from police brutality to the environment to LGBT rights to the Chicago mayoral election of 2015. That surge of political activism on the national level is the topic of a new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, by University of Illinois professor Robert McChesney. That book and issues raised by it is the focus of this interview with Chicago Indy Media's Mitchell Stupinchik, recorded on February 23rd, 2015.
Bob McChesney, welcome back to the show.
Hey, my pleasure to be here, Mitchell.
First, if you could briefly explain, what's the book about, and what do you mean by the title, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century? What does that refer to?
Well, let me start with the title. You know, the book is a series of essays that are, some were written specifically for this book, some were recent research I've done on related themes about politics. And the argument I make in the book, and that I make in at least the title, is that we have a number of things going on in the United States and the world today that are not tenable. They're not going to be able to go indefinitely without some sort of response. And I talk about the extraordinary growth of political and economic inequality, the absolute decline, if not elimination, of viable democratic governance in the United States, the rise of militarism, so it's completely unchecked, and also the environmental climate crisis. And these are problems that, you know, Americans right now in sort of depoliticized culture sort of are sleeping through or feel powerless to do anything about, might be a better way to put it. But they're problems that aren't going to go away of their own volition, or they're going to get better of their own volition. They're here for the long haul, and I think it's going to lead to some sort of radical explosion. Whether it's going to be a good explosion or a bad one, that'll be determined by us, by what we do. But we're you know, strap on your seatbelt. The next few decades are going to be a wild ride. And I've argued in the book, if we understand the phenomena that are taking place, that we can actually intervene to create an extraordinarily positive outcome. And if we don't intervene effectively or successfully, we let people who are in power now continue to be pretty much in power without any resistance or counter, I think we will get more of the same, and I think that is not a very pleasurable prospect in my mind.
You deal with a number of important but difficult issues regarding political activism and the prospects, and it's one reason why I found the book a really appealing read. Let's talk about one of them in particular. You cite the example of a professor of yours when you were in graduate school, quoting from your book, a white South African who was strongly supportive of the anti-apartheid movement and highly knowledgeable about South Africa, but who, when you last saw him in 1988, you described as unusually glum, and who you described as saying he felt that the chances for abolishing apartheid, mind you, this was in 1988, were more remote than ever. Yet, nevertheless, in 4 years' time, apartheid was abolished, Nelson Mandela was freed, and he actually became president of South Africa. It would seem to me that, drawing on this as an example, that a big lesson that from this is that sometimes we shouldn't even be fooled by the evidence that's at play. So I guess my question to you is, do you think that when it comes to matters regarding human affairs, and whether or not people should be engaged in political activism, we shouldn't be fooled by the evidence that there's little chance for success?
Well, I think that we really, no one can predict the future, so that's what I was trying to make. You know, for example, if you look at all the great social movements that have taken place historically, You know, no one saw them coming 2 years before they happened. No one saw the civil rights movement. Howard Zinn's written about this before it happened. No one saw the feminist movement before it happened. I mean, once it happens, everybody says, yeah, I saw it coming. But no one saw it coming. No one saw Occupy before it happened. No one saw the Cairo uprising before it happened. The point is, it's almost impossible to predict the future. And where I think I might disagree with you, Mr. is that I think it's human nature, if I can be so, make such a vulgar generalization, to think that what exists around me now existed yesterday, it exists today, so it's logically going to exist tomorrow. It has a small c conservative effect that makes it impossible to envision how things can change if all you've seen is the status quo yesterday, the day before, and today. You logically think tomorrow's just going to be more of the same. And that has a demobilizing effect on people. Well, gee whiz, there's really not much I can do about it. It's more of the same that's going on. And my point is that that's nonsensical. The one thing we know for sure is everything's changing radically. The question is whether we're going to participate in it or not. The only thing we also can be certain is no one can predict where it's going. There's way too many variables. It's impossible to have any way of accurately forecasting the future.
I would hope that that would actually be something of an encouraging fact as far as whether or not people get involved as far as kind of political activism. And I suppose that's actually kind of a follow-up point. On the face of it, people would understandably be dissuaded, going back to the vulgar characterization of human nature, that I wouldn't want to, me being John Q. Public, I wouldn't want to get involved in political activism if I didn't see that there was some kind of tangible expression down the road. And yet, I suppose it's the feeling that we wouldn't know how close or how far we are from a transformational victory. So I guess in that sense, how would we know if we're really close or really far? Or is that just a fool's errand to try to think that we're really close or really far and we have to keep going? What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I think that we generally, like I do in the book, say, look, there's something here that simply won't go on, last forever. The status quo, something's got to give. We don't know if it's going to be in 6 months, 6 years, or 40 years, but something's going to change, and it's probably going to be tumultuous, the change. I mean, that's what we can do as scholars, as citizens, as journalists. We can look at the world, study it, and come to those conclusions and compare it to other historical periods. And I think that's fair game to be on, fair ground. Someone, for example, takes the 18th century, someone living in the United States in 1780 or 1805, who thought slavery was an obscenity and should be abolished, they probably could logically look out the window and said, boy, this is going to be here for a long time, probably going to go past my lifetime. So I'm just going to put my head down, do my own thing, and not really worry about it because I know it's horrible, but there's no chance of changing it in the next 5 years. It's not worth me putting any energy to it. And, that's a rational way to respond. But if we look back at history now, the people who we respect and admire aren't the people who said, well, it's impossible to beat the system, so I'm just going to go with them and let the next generation worry about it. But it's the people who said, this is wrong. And, I'm a human being, and my experience isn't just bounded by my own life on this earth. Even if something won't change during my lifetime, I can do my bit to make a change later during my children or grandchildren's lifetime or the children during the future of my species. So, I think in a way we're talking about existential issues here. What people do is they deal with the world we live in, and then they look in the mirror what they see and what they want to see. The thing I would add, though, Mitchell, that's in this book, is that increasingly this isn't just sort of an esoteric decision made by people who basically, my choice is to be politically active, or I'm going to go play softball, or I'm going to be, practice my bowling. We're dealing in a world increasingly where the importance of politics is being hammered over our heads every day. Take what's going on in Greece or Spain, what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri. These are not really optional issues for people. These aren't like, I think I'm going to go to the dance tonight. Oh, no, I think I'll do politics instead. It's really increasingly the crisis is so severe. It's a life and death matter that really doesn't give you an option. You are forced to do what's right and to stand up. And I would argue that I think as I look at the United States today and much of the world, we're entering a situation in which the option of just sort of zoning out, doing your thing, and living a nice luxury life in the middle class, you know, that option will be a lot around for some people, but for most, I think that's going to be a nostalgic vision.
Changing topics a little bit, you have a chapter in the book that you've entitled The Wisconsin Uprising. You discuss the protests that enveloped Madison, Wisconsin in 2011 against Governor Scott Walker. You describe the, I guess you could characterize the protests that took place at the time as being prescient and optimistic. But yet, and I could understand where someone may, maybe even someone sympathetic to the protests may say, They didn't really do much because they didn't achieve their ostensible goal of, at least on their face, reversing policies or removing Scott Walker from office. In fact, he actually not only won re-election twice, he actually won a recall election and is now regarded as among the leading presidential candidates for the Republican Party 2016 U.S. presidential election. So my question, Bob, for you is, do you think it's fair or is it correct to characterize what happened in Madison in 2011 as a defeat or a failure?
No, I don't, because it was understood by anyone who followed Wisconsin politics, and I live in Madison most of the time. I was at the demonstrations probably four or five days a week for 6 weeks in the winter of 2011, and I was a backbencher. I wasn't up there, you know, standing on the podium talking. I was just in the throng with my friends and my fellow citizens participating. And, I mean, we knew all along that legally we had no standing. The Republicans could not only have the governorship, but they also controlled with a veto-proof majority both sides of the legislature. So it wasn't like we thought we were going to get these guys to change their mind. We knew they were on the take with the Koch brothers. We knew they were extremely hard right in a way the Republican Party had not been in Wisconsin in its history, except for, like, branches of it, like the McCarthy branch. So, you know, it wasn't like we had the illusion that we're necessarily going to win legally. And I think what we knew, though, is we had to demonstrate to show how outrageous getting rid of the right to have a union was. And I think that was successful. And I would say it was successful, too, in that this was something that was, if there's been an unplanned uprising in my life, this was it. I mean, it took basically the graduate student union at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the teachers' union, union for the city of Madison, were really central to organizing this and getting it off the ground. And then it exploded. There was this wellspring of support from across the state. And the protests, and I write about it in the book, if someone was there, it was a moving experience that is almost impossible to describe unless you were there. At times, crowds as large as 125 or 150,000 people, and the solidarity that we felt with each other. So, no, I don't think it was a loss whatsoever, that experience alone. And I think the real lesson of Madison and the lesson going forward is that there is a volcano of Democratic sentiment among a huge portion of the American people that want to build a society where people are working together, where we don't have poor people, where there's no corruption, a good society that takes advantage of the immense wealth of this country and wants to do away with the corruption and inequality that now dominate our society. And that it just takes a little match, and it's like a prairie fire, takes off. That's what Madison was all about. That's what Occupy was all about. And it got the attention of people in power who are now scared to death. But that sentiment hasn't gone away. The conditions have not improved. It will come back, and it will be even more ferocious in the years to come.
In the book, you mentioned a number of topics. Like, for example, the topics that I actually have not read from your writings, but they're nonetheless pretty important. Like, for example, you've got a chapter on the penal state in America and another chapter on the escalation of military spending in the U.S. government budget. Can you talk a little bit about why you included these chapters in the book? It would seem like they might just, you know, they might actually dissuade people who might read this book and take a lesson of optimism. They may say, oh, look, things suck. And here's evidence that they suck and suck even more, and the trajectory is going to continue. Are you afraid that those, including those chapters, might actually douse the flames of potential activism? Or might they, why talk a little bit about why they're there?
Well, I mean, I believe my job as a scholar and as a writer is to sort of present my honest picture of the world as I see it. And the reason I think people should be active, I don't think I should do like a Madison Avenue sales pitch to try to get them to do something they wouldn't do otherwise based on some sort of deceptive method or some PR scheme. I mean, I think the reason those chapters are in there is, let me put it in broader context, Mitchell. There's another chapter in the book that comes right before those two, a couple chapters earlier, that really sets them up. And that's called A New Deal Under Obama. And that chapter, like the other two, I co-authored with my close friend John Bellamy Foster, the editor of Monthly Review Magazine, who I've written a lot with over the last 10 or 20 years. And that chapter we wrote after the 2008 election, but prior to Obama taking office in 2009, just as the Great Recession was hitting the fan and no one knew what was going to happen with the economy. And a lot of people were speculating, hey, maybe we're going to get a new deal here. Maybe Obama, winning by a landslide with overwhelming majorities in the House and Senate, with tremendous goodwill publicly, will do what FDR did and use this as an opportunity to put in substantive reforms that will get the economy working, that will build out the public sector and the infrastructure of the country. And so in that essay, which is in the book, is one of the essays I'm proudest of that I've ever written. John Bellamy Foster and I basically said, well, let's look at the New Deal. Let's look at what they did exactly. And the argument we made in there, and the data, it's all hard research, is that the crucial factor in the New Deal and in European social democracy, you see a sharp increase in civilian spending by the government, not on military stuff, but on public goods, public works, education, welfare, parks, transportation. And if you look at the New Deal, during the 1930s, there was actually a sharp increase overall in such spending. It was crucial to taming the Depression and correcting it, but there wasn't anywhere near enough. I mean, it was actually relatively weak. But what's striking about it was that civilian spending by the government, non-military spending, peaked at about 13 or 14% in 1939, doubled over the decade. And it's basically been at that level ever since. No matter who's in office, government civilian spending in the GDP is roughly 13 or 14%. It hasn't gone up appreciably. And so we thought, we wanted to, why was that? Why is this sort of locked in? And if Obama's going to do a new deal, he was going to have to significantly raise that figure to put money into the economy. And our argument was that, the problem in America, going back to the 40s, has been that elites in this country oppose government spending, civilian spending, because they find it threatening and dangerous to their interests. So the only type of government spending that was approved that the elites would not battle against, and there weren't entrenched interests that would oppose, was military spending. And that leads to the next chapter, which shows the huge increase in military spending, which has been foundational to American capitalism for the last 60 or 70 years, and which really defines American capitalism in no small extent. It's such an important part of our political economy, and it's completely off limits in our political culture. It's simply not debated, but criticized, the whole national security military state. And so we put it in that context to explain why we got militarism, one of the core factors, and why it's grown and why it's so huge. And there's a macroeconomic reason. And then finally, I'm going on and on like a professor here, but the last piece, which is on prisons and the penal state, when you think about it, and I was thinking about this like 5 years ago, going, well, that's interesting. Civilian spending by the government is pretty much a constant. This includes federal, local, and state governments. Pretty much been constant at 13 or 14% of the GDP since the late 1930s. That doesn't square with what we know about American politics since the 1970s, where it's gotten much more conservative, where social spending's been slashed. You would have expected that percentage to drop down to 11 or 12% or 10% as education, health care spending got cut by governments. And that did take place. And what the penal piece shows is that as government spending on social programs declined, it was replaced by a huge increase in penal spending in prisons. And that's really replaced a lot of what's been the civilian spending. And so those three chapters of the piece are sort of a political economy of the federal budget and why our country looks the way it is. And I think we're trying to make the case that if someone's going to challenge that, be it Obama or any other politician, they really have a big job in front of them, one that certainly Obama did not have the courage to do, even understood it that way, but that would require a mass movement to address these huge institutional money forces now that are entrenched.
Relying on the powers that be for any kind of, you know, change or impact along these lines is basically a non-starter. It seems like that election actually quote a chap, probably my favorite quote in the whole book, page 223 in the book, quote, "The political economic situation in the United States is unstable and ultimately untenable. When one factors in the environmental crisis, this becomes an even more calamitous and desperate period. What is striking is that all the pay-ins to the genius of the market, which remain commonplace in policy or academic debates on communication, now increasingly smell like month-old fish left out on a table. Though the news has yet to hit the corrupt elites in Washington, academia, or the mainstream news media, it is increasingly understood by a beleaguered citizenry." So, Bob, a question for you. Regarding the genius of the market, when will the news hit corrupt elites that the market isn't that great of a genius? Is it going to be after the proverbial revolution? Is it going to be when they can't ignore the runaway? What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a prediction I would have trouble making, and it depends which elites you're talking about, too. I think for those part of our elite that are basically rich and draw their money from investments and ownership and have a great deal of money and think they should be the rightful rulers of society, and most billionaires think that way, they're always going to believe in the genius of the market. It's done very well for them, and they, you know, their world probably has a hard time understanding the idea that there should be, you know, education and libraries and parks and public transportation, because these are things they would never use. They would have their own world that they can buy and sell as they please. They don't need public facilities. So I don't think we're ever going to convince them. I don't think they'll ever change their mind. I think that's pretty much deep. That's deep wired in their institutional role in society. They're not going to change. What the crucial factor here is that people who don't benefit by the system, which I think is the vast majority of people in the country. I mean seriously vast, well into the 90%. They're the ones who need to basically say this deal isn't working anymore for us. And I think as one studies it, these great speeches we hear about the free market and competitive capitalism, you know, they're really ridiculous. If you look at actually how capitalism works in the real world, I mean, the sort of stuff about heroic entrepreneurs competing to create jobs and all sorts of competition and little guys rising to the top, this sort of vision of competitive free market capitalism that we're fed constantly has as much to do with the real world of capitalism as the talk about, you know, worker democracy did to sort of accurate reflection of communism in Eastern Europe. You know, it just simply was nonsense. And, you know, the real world of capitalism, the one Americans experience every day, is one of enormous corporations with immense amount of power that gouge consumers and small businesses, that, you know, own the politicians and have completely corrupt governance, that dominate the media and have a huge public relations and lobbying arsenal that sort of play an outsized role in public life, and where we see inequality growing to staggering levels compared to 30 or 40 years ago, poverty increasing, and a world for young people, which is increasingly one where it doesn't look like they're going to need that many jobs. The jobs that are going to be out there, for the most part, are going to suck badly. And that's the real world of capitalism. And I think that fairy tale version, which the politicians all love and we hear from the media all the time, that version doesn't work with young people in the same way today. If you're unemployed and can't find a job, or if you're struggling to get by, the stuff about you not working hard enough, if you did, you'd be a billionaire, that I think increasingly is like a crock of you know what.
I'd like to talk about another chapter in the book, the one that you entitled A Sharp Left Turn for the Media Reform Movement. And this is something I think that you and I, this resonates with both with the two of us, considering we've both been involved in the media reform movement. You describe your critical opinion regarding the genius of the market, one which in the interest of full disclosure, is something I share. You mentioned that increasingly strains credulity. And yet, at least for the moment, it seems like the media reform movement writ large, which you and I have been involved with, that has been making inroads regarding policy in everything from media concentration to net neutrality to low-power FM radio to a number of things, has been making appeals to the market in various policy statements. So I'd like you if you could discuss what some people might consider to be a little bit of a contradiction. Could it be that the movement is kind of talking the talk and trying to get increasing public involvement and trying to win people over in what would otherwise be an abstruse policy? Or do we think that the media reform movement writ large is as critical of markets as I think you or I would be? What do you think?
Well, that's a great question. That's an issue I've wrestled with. You know, I helped co-found Free Press, which has done fantastic work working on a range of issues, including the battle to preserve network neutrality on the internet. And but you're absolutely right. Free Press, as well as most of the other groups involved in media reform, oftentimes invoke the idea that these monopoly firms, the solution to them is more competition. So instead of just having one or two companies to get broadband or cell phone service from, we can make it so you have three or four, that'll be a really much better deal and probably a solution to the problem. More competition equals the solution to the problem. And, you know, I think you're right. That's the point I make in the book. I don't think that's an accurate picture, and I think it's misleading. Now, I think there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, part of why the media reform movement has done that and it continues to do that. One, there is a certain amount of accuracy. It is such a corrupt and such a monopolistic area virtually across the board that it's hard not to say if you can blast it open a little bit, that won't be better. It will be better. So fair enough. That's true. But the problem with it is, and I think the other reason is that, you know, if you want to get taken seriously in Washington so you get your phone calls answered or you get, you know, you're not kicked out of the room at a public meeting, you better have that pay onto the market or you're going to have, you're going to face a ferocious assault from the right that you can hardly believe. I mean, it is sort of the anti-human mission to be credible is that the primacy of profits generated in markets over communication has to be taken. As a foundation belief. And I, you know, where I come from in my research and my teaching and why we founded Free Press was the belief that media and communication and journalism tend to be public goods. The market does them poorly, that does insufficient quantity or quality, and that these systems are always created by explicit government policies using subsidies, and they need to be made in the public interest by the public in informed debate. So it's a very different way of looking at this. And I think that that vision of media reform is also present in Free Press. It's also present in these other groups, but it's not loudly proclaimed in the debates, at least when any politicians or journalists are around.
So then if I were to, say, voice my criticism of markets, but also try to express it in a kind of sense regarding media reform, I imagine it would probably go about as high as a lead balloon. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, you'd have to be very careful in how you accept it. Explained it. You know, you'd be easily red baited, even if you were, you know, and again, this is the work I try to do, and it's difficult work. You know, even by free market economics, communication has never been a free market industry. It's never, journalism has never been. I mean, it's the reason why copyright's in the Constitution. You couldn't have commercial book publishing unless you granted monopoly rights to authors or to publishers in order to write books, because they couldn't get any money. And it's not a free market industry. It requires explicit government policies to create markets in the first place. And with that then comes tough decisions about what sort of markets do you want to create? Who are you going to favor? What values will guide it? And so there's never really a free market solution. When they use the term free market solution in communication policymaking, that just means, you know, you're going to let the rich guys screw everyone else over and own the politicians.
So I guess another question would be, how do we break this logjam? If markets are uber alles, so to speak, that they're, you know, beyond reproach and beyond criticism, and yet a reasonable claim could be made that they're a big reason why we're in the pickle we're in regarding, you know, the economy and the environment and pick any topic you want. I mean, is it going to be the case where, you know, we'll be able to break this logjam once the skies fill red with blood and earthquakes emerge and, you know, we're basically turn the planet into a desert? Or do we think that, you know, there could be some other way that we'd be able to break through this logjam? What do you think?
Well, you know, this is where we're with our point of departure, Mitchell. You know, I'm not really sure exactly how to, because I do know this. the most important thing is to tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. Not try to, shape the truth to make it more palatable. I mean, you want to make it accessible and coherent, but you don't want to doctor it. And so as a journalist, as a writer, as a scholar, that's what I try to do. Now, you know, my argument would be that social changes will take place and does take place, not just because there'll be people who are concerned about an esoteric issue like net neutrality, but I think the real power that gets hundreds of thousands of people to the streets, that gets them really seriously concerned, is when it comes home. And I think that's what's happening right now in America. It comes home in terms of really sharply declining standards of living, which are due to corruption and an economy that's not set up to work for average people, increasing unemployment and underemployment. We have the worst job market for people in their 20s in America today that we've had since the 1930s, probably, or 40s. You know, it's going to take a very long time. And for college graduates, it's probably the worst it's ever been, because in the 30s, there weren't that many college graduates, so it was a lot easier to get jobs. Today, we've just got tons of people with college degrees. Like over half of the people who finish with college degrees now are taking jobs you don't really need a college degree for. And that means that people who only have high school degrees are competing with people with BAs to get jobs that really are only meant for high school grads. So we've got this downward pressure that I think is really going to be the trigger for everything going forward. We've got just, you know, an economy that is not working, and it causes great problems, and it also reflects the great corruption that affects everything, where you have a handful of really powerful, wealthy interests that floss their teeth with the politicians' underpants, and they build a system that suits them and is screwing everyone else over.
A couple of chapters in the book actually talk about your own experience, and I'd like to discuss that a little bit. For example, you had your own, speaking of the radio program that was on WILL AM 580 out of Urbana, Illinois, a program called Media Matters. And you talked about it and some of the success, and I would like to, if you could now, to elaborate on some of the ways you felt it was successful, please.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that, Mitch. Yeah, I put that in the book because, I had a show on WILL, the NPR affiliate at the University of Illinois, from 2002 until 2012, 10 and a half years. I mean, I did over 500 original shows in that 10 and a half years. It was an hour-long call-in show. Maybe some of the listeners here heard it. It's all the podcasts are available online. And the idea of the show was that I'd have generally one guest, sometimes two, but usually one guest every week for an hour. And they would, not always, it used to be someone who's outside the range of legitimate debate that you would get on, you know, in MSNBC or commercial media for discussion, Fox or CNN or talk radio, and give them an opportunity to explain their views of the world, take calls, and give long answers if they wanted. I remember one show I had Noam Chomsky on, and he was on probably 10 times over the course of the program. And I think I asked Chomsky four or five questions the whole show, and he maybe got one or two callers in. Because his answers, he was able to talk for 7-8 minutes to give a really detailed, complex answer to the questions, which he enjoyed, and I think the listeners loved. So I tried to basically be an alternative to what was generally available. And I think the show was a great success based on, you know, all the conventional and unconventional data you can get. Times for Eyes, it did well. The ratings that the station got, it always did extremely well. On downloads and hits at the website, it always did extremely well. And it was a lot of fun to do. I will give the whole list of guests. People can go online and find it. But it was a who's who of a lot of the great journalists, activists, writers, and thinkers of our time. And so that's what I did. And the question in the chapter I wanted to pose was, you know, what does this say about NPR that this was the only show, to my knowledge, in the history of public radio in the United States like this, where you had someone, you know, I'm explicitly on the left, but if you listen to the show, you know, I rarely interjected my opinions. It was always about the guests, and there was no yelling and screaming. There was none of the badgering people. And a lot of people probably listen to the show and not really know my opinion at all, because it was never really about me. I had plenty of chances to, you know, be on other shows that I want to give my opinion on stuff. But it was a chance to just have thoughtful conversation. I think it was deeply enjoyed. But unfortunately, you know, but we tried to get other stations in the NPR network to say, if you want to carry this show, it's doing spectacularly well for us, both for money, for audience, and happy people in our community. We get no one who wanted to take it. No one even wanted to imitate it. And I was hoping that what would happen is that, you know, Albuquerque, New Mexico, or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, some NPR station in some other city, Chicago, would go and find someone like me. There are people, you know, it's like, I'm not that special. Anyone could do the show. You know, it's like college professors could do it. By our journalists to do a similar show in their town with people in their community. And they would have found it was inexpensive and deeply popular, but no one did. And when I finally gave the show up 2.5 years ago, I wasn't replaced at will. I think we went to robot automated format, no humans in the building on the weekends. So they just continued doing the show for financial reasons. And then no other stations are really doing it either. And it's a big loss. I mean, I think the American conversation is very narrow as a rule, and having shows like that made a difference. And I'll tell you what I mean by that, Mitchell. I got, when I decided not to do the show, and I announced I stopped doing it, I got around 300 letters or emails. 300, and that's a lot. And they were from all over the world, but a lot of them were for young people. And the young people would say, you know, I never heard you guys before. I just listened to the radio and I came across your show and I heard this stuff I'd never heard before. And I started listening to it regularly. Now I get the podcast. And again, this is from all over the world, not just in Illinois. And it just changed my life. And it reinforced to me how important media is. Why this show you're doing, Mitchell, is really important. Because there might be one person who listens to it, it could change their life. Listening to media like this changed my life when I was a teenager in Cleveland, Ohio. So, it reinforced how important media are and why the battle to have an open media system is so important for the future of the country.
Actually, a little bit of a confession. There was actually a TV show that I happened to see where I was growing up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, the week after I graduated from high school that actually helped to, I guess, open my eyes as well to various critical perspectives and helped to change my life and is a big reason why I've done and have continued to do the work now. A final question for you, Bob. When we started this conversation, you had talked about the difference between a good explosion and a bad explosion. Suppose I am a young person, maybe just out of high school or maybe in college or somewhere in the early part of life, and I feel like I want to try to make a difference. What would you recommend, maybe broadly speaking, to someone who wants to help to steer things, even if in a little bit, toward the future in a good explosion rather than a bad explosion? Any general advice or recommendations?
Well, boy, we're going to have to do another show related to this topic. My next book deals a lot more with the downside of what's coming if we don't get active. We might scare people. I'll be the bad cop in the next book. But I would say the most important thing is, you know, get educated, get smart, get outside the mainstream, learn a lot, be critical. And also, I would say, find people who share your values and interests and hang around with them. Don't give up your other friends. Try to talk them into this stuff. But get around some people who, you know, are looking positively towards the future, what can be done. But the most important thing I would say is that, you know, everyone has their own comfort zone. You know, I, for example, I like writing. I like talking. So being a professor is a good job for me. But there are some people I know who just, those aren't their comfort zone. That's not the sort of thing like they like to do. So they do something else. You find what you're good at, what you enjoy doing, and really develop that, apply those skills then to try to help the cause of moving the country in a more democratic direction. Don't try to be what you're not. But the most important thing is, too, I would say, having come of age in the 70s, one of the things that really killed politics in the 70s was that it went from being that something that was joyous among people who loved each other, and I mean that seriously, to being something that was like Lutheran penance that you did because you felt you had to do something that you didn't really enjoy. And it got pretty short. Once it got like that, you knew it was going to go downhill and unravel. Successful movements for social change have dynamism, but they also have a great deal of enjoyment and camaraderie and collegiality. And never forget that part of the picture.
That was an interview with Robert McChesney, speaking about his book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. The book's website is blowingtheroofoff.com. We're coming to you from the trenches.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day.
That was an excerpt of the song Glory by John Legend and Common from the film Selma. Activism on civil rights and on justice... Activism on civil rights and on justice issues is on the upswing and has clear connections to history. This was the focus of a recent discussion with Dr. Timuel Black, civil rights activist and educator, who spoke at Chicago's Third Unitarian Church. The following is an excerpt of the conversation with Dr. Black with Laurel Schmidt, recorded on January 18, 2015.
Why did Dr. King and his movement succeed when so many previous civil rights, other people had attempted to achieve civil rights and it hadn't worked?
So. Well, Dr. King was a leader, and I mean that in every way that you can describe it. Not only was he a person who was giving up something to be a leader, but he could brilliantly articulate the causes for which he had been chosen to be the leader. For those of us who accepted him as being our leader, one of the reasons was because of the fearlessness that he exhibited. He was not afraid of anything, and it made you ashamed to act like you were afraid of anything if you were with him. That was the kind of, and then more than ordinary people, he could articulate in understandable but also spiritual tone why you should be going forward. And that spirituality was something that was inspirational. And then another part of that leadership that you felt, his availability, that you thought, regardless of what time of the day or night, you might have something you wanted to work on. All you had to do was call Doc up and he'd be there. That was not realistic, wow. But that was a feeling about that kind of leadership, always. And that feeling of he couldn't be bought. He was trustworthy. He was not purchasable. Those elements of his character inspired those of us who may have had the same goals that he had, but did not feel that we could make it, but those characteristics made us feel comfortable and feel assured that we could meet the goal that we, in our own personal lives, had aspirations to. that he embodied all of those qualities, and therefore he was our leader. Does that help a little bit?
Very good, yes. So you didn't get the feeling that if you called him up or if you stopped to talk to him, he'd say, you know, go away, I'm important, I'm a busy man, I've got people to save and worlds to change? Or...
No, he was so patient that it was astounding. You thought the way that he would stop, that you were the most important person in his life. That was the way he would make you feel. And the fact that he could do that so well with so many people made it easier for you to have faith and trust in him, because it was so, that way in which, you know, he called me Brother Black. I called him Dr. King, and we might embrace. I was not the only person that he would do that with. So you felt obligated by the way in which he treated you in his style of life. And the fact that you felt he was tireless in his efforts to bring about change made you obligated to be tireless at feeling in terms of following his leadership. That was true in the South particularly. So those of us who went South to give support, we had to be trained. Let me tell you, we had to be trained to be nonviolent, white and black, brown or whoever, because we were from the North, generally were not nonviolent. And so because of respect for Dr. King, we obeyed. With him, it was a way of life. With most of us from the North, it was a tactic. So when he came here to Marquette Park and they knocked him down and were burning things, burned cars and things, and they knocked Dr. King down, I said to myself, if one of them hit me, the nonviolent movement is over. I could take it in the South, but not in this area. I don't want nobody saying he knocked you down. So that, I'm saying again, was the, and so I then said I will not, because I don't want to embarrass, I will not be in these kind of marches anymore in the North. So that was the spirit of Dr. King. Thank you.
I forgot to tell you that Mr. Black is a Unitarian. He's a member of First Church and has been since 1954, I think
1954.
You said.
Mm-hmm.
So one, what got him to go to Selma, and I assume this was for like the second or third march that you went to Selma?
We went right after Pettus Bridge.
Okay. When Reverend Reeb was killed, so that was one of the inspirations for Mr. Black to go to Selma.
And that was an organized thing for those of us who went from the Unitarian Church. And I cannot remember the assistant minister from Unitarian who went with us and who did some of the organizing. But he had gone to a missionary school, whatever school, with a minister whose ministry was in Selma. Now, they were friends, but this minister in Selma, not out of thought about his safety, but in opposition to the march, tried to discourage him from being there. And when we got there, he continued to try and discourage my assistant pastor, who continued to organize the march. And one of the things I remember, this is after the Pettus Bridge with Diane Nash and that young group of activist. Diane Nash, by the way, is a girl from Chicago and went to Hyde Park High School. And so when we came out of the church after Dr. King had made his comments and sermons, I think, anyway, I can't remember all of the details. When you get to be 96, you'll understand. Then the Jim Clark, or the sheriff in that area, was waiting for us to come out so he could have his men beat us up. There were a group, a small group, of Catholic sisters who were with us, and they looked very, not painfully anyway, looked at each other and said, "Shall we move to the front?" And those sisters moved to the front of the line, which kept us from getting really beat up, because by that time, television is viewing all over the country and all over the world. And that kept us in that front line from getting pummeled. That's just an incident that many people may not know, but I was there and saw that. This is not from Selma to Montgomery complete. This is after the murder of the Unitarian minister and our desire to show support for the movement in Selma. But after that, after we had made that kind of symbolic march, it was easier for President Johnson to then publicly give more support to the Voter Rights Act. And I think, I'm getting my memory, he got an executive order that the voter rights would be extended to all people, which later became verified by the Congress, which at that time became afraid that they might lose their jobs if they didn't support what the president had already supported. But the march gave a dramatic impetus to bringing about voter rights in the South, and later, though it was more subtle, transfer some of those rights to the North.
So I'm going to take a real risk here. As a Unitarian, what did you mean when you talked about King's spiritual strength and what that brought to the movement?
Well, I think that all of us, in one way or the other, without necessarily articulating it, have a feeling of a future, a spirituality, that something, a change is going to come. And the civil rights movement gave a sense of direction for that change. The feeling is there. The direction has to be articulated by someone who you have confidence in and will move forward with. So as a Unitarian, we might say not necessarily committed to any particular designated religion, that feeling was still a part of my life, along with fellow Unitarians. And so when that feeling is there, it carries you forward. When I was in World War II, we were bombed regularly in London, and then when we went into Europe, into France, there were some of our soldiers who didn't believe that tomorrow was going to be a better day. So we had suicides in our units. But most of us felt that regardless to what we saw, actually saw, that we were going to keep on going, and as I hear this music, that we shall overcome. And it's that part of life that keeps most people going. I believe that all people have at some time had negative things happen that made them wonder what tomorrow is worth living for. But then the spirit of their life comes up and they believe and begin to operate that they shall overcome. So that feeling carried us through the marches as we marched through the streets of Montgomery and Birmingham and Selma and other places that the particularly young people kept marching behind Dr. King, even in Memphis, where the violence, where Dr. King was finally assassinated. What other element that is not tangible can anyone have when the adversities of today seem impossible to deal with if you don't have a feeling of tomorrow?
That was a conversation with Dr. Tim Well Black, civil rights activist and educator. A longer excerpt is available online at the Chicago Indie Media website. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more, listen to past episodes of From the Trenches, and get involved in making media and help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Rita Sand for audio assistance, and thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode, From the Trenches.